What's the secret sauce of successful investing? One school says it's simply to quit trying to beat the markets. Just stay calm, cut costs, stay invested, and accept what the markets are offering, come hell or high water. Over the long term, they say you'll probably do fine. Another school agrees that both freaking out and tolerating unnecessary costs, yeah, those will hurt you. But it disagrees that the only remaining alternative is non-selective buy-and-hold market cap index investing. Instead, asks this school, why not apply some of the repeatedly validated research and tilt your portfolio toward things that offer long-term edges? All else being equal, edges like preferring highly profitable companies whose stocks are currently on sale and whose stocks are rising faster than most. Today we explain this second approach, commonly known as factor-based investing. And since yours truly runs several such models, we discuss how they're designed, when and why they sometimes underperform, how they've worked more recently, and what sort of investor temperament is needed to stay with them. We also offer some tips and resources to help you extend your learning and, if you're so inclined, to try some of these approaches yourself. Stay tuned for all these ideas and more right now on the Retirement Lifestyle Show.
Welcome. You are listening to the Retirement Lifestyle Show with Roshan Lungani, Eric Olson, and Adrian Nicholson. This show is an exploration of ideas to help you work toward your ideal retirement. Get ready for the financial independence of your dreams.
Welcome to the Retirement Lifestyle Show. I'm your co-host, Roshan Lungani, here. We got the team together again. I wasn't there last week. We've got Eric Olson and Adrian Nicholson. Adrian, I want to start with you. You had an exciting day yesterday. Congratulations.
Yes, we got a new car. I'm really excited about it. Yeah, I'm really hyped to drive the new car. It's really awesome. We got a 2023 Volkswagen Tiguana. And we're just really happy to have a new car. My old one broke down right after the wedding. Perfect timing, right? So nothing better to start off a year with a new car, that's for sure.
I like those little cars.
At least it didn't break down before.
Nice. So that German vibe, too. It's going to be, you'll have that it's BMW-like experience in a not BMW-like price. Fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we needed a new SUV.
I think I've got to call you out. I believe that's Alex's new car from what you told me,
yes,
right?
But we're married now, so it's our car.
Oh, that's
since
great.
We're married.
I'm just joking. Adrian was telling me how Alex is more in the car, so he was just like letting her pick what, like, everything she wants. What a great husband, right? Alex gets whatever she wants.
Yeah, I was just sticking on the cost and figuring out the best way to finance and everything. I just said, just pick whatever you want. I'll just see if this works. And it worked out really well. I'm glad we only spent like 2 hours in the dealership as well. Roshan, I heard you had some nightmare experiences at dealership, so I was really worried going into it. So it went very smoothly.
Yeah, that's great, actually. That sounds like a wonderful process. My nightmare experience was 12 hours in a dealership with a six-month-old.
Oh, no.
And they would not let us leave. I was like, you tell me the price. Let me just take the car and go. And the whole, we've got to see this manager, that manager, back. And it was a nightmare. So I've just used Costco cars and True Car, and that's it.
Which is not an advertisement. It's just a report, correct?
They're not a sponsor
of the show.
Correct. It is not an advertisement. Yes, they're not sponsoring us. If they want to, please call us. We'll consider the offer. Eric, how about you? How was your last week, your weekend? Anything interesting going on?
Yeah, it's been lots of snow. I finally got to put my snowblower, the giant, the big boy, put that thing to work. It was so fun. So over and over, loved it.
How much snow?
I think in one couple day period, we had about 15 inches, something like that. And then just a little bit more here, 3-4 inches just yesterday.
Schools open or do they close them?
Oh yeah, schools, they kept them open. Mm-hmm.
So to tell you how soft we are with snow, we had a dusting this morning of less than an eighth of an inch. It was just out there when we went, and we're so weak. My children actually asked if school was open because they close with such a little snow down here. But let's jump into the topic. I'm really excited about today's topic. For everyone, I think this will be a good one. I'm a student of investing, and Eric and I have talked about investments together for 15 plus years. I think we've had conversations. So Eric's going to share with us factor investing and one of the methodologies he uses, how he utilizes factor investing. And I'm really excited to talk to you about it. I'm sure I'll have a ton of questions. Whenever we go through any topic, we've got to share this disclaimer that this is not advice. This is purely informational. And for research purposes, since we're talking about one that's so close to home, you will hear that disclaimer throughout this episode as we go through the different features of the program. But Eric, when you're ready, please start us off.
Well, sure. I guess I will just begin by saying that the way in which I think you think about investing and I think about investing is very eclectic to begin with, but also very research driven. So we recognize that research can lead you in the direction of things that are useful and productive in the long term. That doesn't mean that they'll be productive in comparative terms, in every phase. And in fact, you can go through long periods where a tried and true method of investing is lagging for reasons that you've only sometimes well after the fact ever come to fully appreciate why it was that way. So we're going to talk about some factor-based investing approaches today, but I just want to hasten to add, I use these for a minority of a client's portfolio, if at all, because not all clients are necessarily constituted in such a way that they can accept the way in which factor-based investing can work at times. And so I want to talk about that point right now. Let me just define factor-based. So when we talk about investing, many people think that that process is either low-cost index funds, pie chart type investing, or they think of it as taking a flyer on some certain company whose story makes sense, and maybe more than just a flyer, having a commitment to a long-term investment in some company whose prospects seem like they're, at least to the investor, as if they are unfailingly good prospects in the long, long run. So I have clients, for example, this is not an endorsement of these stocks, it's just an example, who've held Coca-Cola for decades. I've had other clients that have held things like Home Depot for decades. They've held, and I could go on with various names. They've just held these positions because over long, long periods of time, they believe in the story of these stocks. And this is not I am not in any way here this morning and wanting to try to condemn that particular approach or indict that particular approach. But another approach, which is neither of those first two categories, namely the broad-based, super diversified, pay no attention to any individual holding, just own everything and hopefully it'll work out in the long run, index-based investing with a market cap tilt usually, or the other side of it, which is more the story, Apple, ExxonMobil, you know, it was other companies of this kind. Instead, it is to say, what is it about a stock that is probabilistically associated with working well for the investor? And then there, it's less about the specific thing they sell or the specific thing they do or how cool they are at any given time in the eyes of the general public. Instead, it's just looking at their attributes. So if you were to look at, for example, many of the attributes that we look at about stocks have to do with how much profit do they generate? And then what does it cost if you're an investor looking to buy them today? What does it cost you to buy every dollar of profit that company tends to generate? That ratio of what it costs to buy some attribute, here earnings, is known as the price to earnings ratio. And there are many other attributes of companies that we can look at. There, that ratio that I just described as a value ratio. Yeah, Roshan.
So, Eric, I want to touch on a couple things that just to repeat, highlight what you said. First is you had mentioned whenever there's a strategy, there can be extended periods of underperformance. That's the phrase that you'll see a lot of times in investment books. I've read it. I've seen it. And we try to position our clients into weight them towards the areas where we don't think that's going to be the case. But to me, the being such a Buffett fan, I have quotes and stuff all the time. A joke in the value space is whenever you start reading that Warren Buffett's lost it, that's when is the best opportunity. So I literally Googled Buffett underperforming to see the last time these articles were out there. And the most recent one I found was February 2021. And what he tends to underperform when the markets are really frothy because he's sitting on cash. So that's just an example that all strategies will have this period, including the great performer Warren Buffett, of this extended period of underperformance. I also liked how you had said that the factor-based investing is not right for everybody, and I would think that's the case for most investment strategies. I've said this before. I've used the term "find your investment personality." So what fits you? Because if you're in something that you're not comfortable with, you won't have the level of comfort to wait to get through any type of difficult or down market like we are now. Going back to that Buffett example, when he underperforms at frothy markets, it's because they're typically holding on to cash waiting for the opportunity. So then you have last year, and Berkshire Hathaway does really well, and all of a sudden Buffett's an investing genius again. But he had to go through a few years of underperformance. But you also hear, is he too old for the market? I remember hearing that a lot during the tech bubble era. So you've just got to. I'm sure he doesn't lose sleep when people say he's lost it or underperforming right now, but you've got to be comfortable enough with your methodology for that. So sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to touch on those two things, but let's jump back in with the factors. You were starting to describe some of the factors, and you started with PE ratio.
Yeah. So I'm just using the term factor for some people is a puzzling one. So I think if we think of it as characteristics or attributes of the companies and of their profitability, and then comparing those attributes to what it costs as an investor to buy those attributes is a way of thinking about investing. And so now what you can do is to take a universe of investments and ask yourself, which of the factors in the long run have proven most closely associated with subsequent outperformance? Now, there's a cottage industry, actually, that is always searching out new factors. I think there's at least 300 different factors that various researchers have identified. And hey, it's a great way if you're bored one afternoon to do a little bit of digging around and then write your next academic paper. I mean, might as well. I'm joking. I'm not slamming academics quite that much, but there is this cottage industry. But in the end, what has proven to be persistent as the handful of factors that have proven most salient over time have been the following. So one is value, and that can be measured in various ways, and we'll come back to that, meaning buying things when they're on sale in relative terms. Number two is momentum. That is a description of the recent, by recent I mean, let's say the last 3, 6, or 12 months or some combination thereof, of the way in which the price or at least the total return has been moving, strongly up, sideways, strongly down, but more a statement either in comparison to other things and how they're moving at the time, or in comparison to itself or some combination thereof. Another is now quality, which is mostly a statement about profitability. And then to a certain extent, I think there's maybe less of a strong conviction about this, is size of companies, and meaning large versus small. Small in the long run has had an edge over large. And then maybe one more, and that would be volatility. All else being equal, lower volatility things, surprisingly, in the same asset class, lower volatility stocks against high volatility stocks also have had tended to have an outperformance. So now the question is, well, if I were thinking about putting those attributes to work in a portfolio, how would I go about that? So let me use, you might say, well, I want to have in the attributes, let's use a sports analogy. Let's assume that you are the director of player personnel for Roshan's favorite team, the Washington Commanders. Isn't that the new name of it? The Washington
yes.
team?
It is okay. It is the new name. Yes. I have mixed feelings, not about the name, but about the team in general.
I know. I was ribbing you a little bit there.
New owner, please come. Please buy this team fast.
You should have picked a different analogy, Eric.
Okay. Let's say I'll beat up on myself a little bit. The Vikings. Okay. I love the Vikings, and I'm deeply saddened by the Vikings all at the same time. So you're the director of player personnel for the Vikings. And you say to one of your recruitment people that you want to go out and you want that person to find players who are big, strong, and fast. And so you wait a few months, and the your aide comes back in and says, "Hey, I found them. They're here. They're ready to go. Let's put them in. You know, suit them up and get them out on the field for training camp." One is a sumo wrestler. One is a world champion weightlifter, and the third is a sprinter. And the director of player personnel says, wait. I said big, strong, and fast. Yeah, that's what they are. Big, strong, and fast. No. What I meant is the players that you identify have to have all of these attributes combined. These won't do. It's the same thing in looking for stocks. You could say, I'm going to build a portfolio where one part of my portfolio is just focused on value. Another part of my portfolio is just focused on momentum. Still another part of my portfolio is strictly focused on, let's say, quality. But you wouldn't necessarily have those things working together in the same way. It would be somewhat more random. So the approach that we tend to say is, or at least the evidence suggests is a better way, is to use multi-factor investing in a way that you identify a combination of these attributes for each of the things that you put to work. And that's what the strategies that I'm going to be talking about in just a few minutes here then actually do. Comments or observations about that?
All right, I'm going to jump in if Adrian, I was giving you a chance so I don't hog Eric's time. I want to recap. So Eric, you had said you're looking at the things that have historically shown outperformance, where value, you're using PE there, momentum, which is the 3, 6, and 12 months of where the price has been moving compared to itself or others, quality, which is profitability, size, small, tending to have an edge versus large, and then volatility, lower volatility has outperformed versus higher volatility, correct? Well, I want to jump very briefly into each of those just to sort of apply what I'll call the common sense test to it, because to me, it makes a lot of sense. First, value, you're buying something that's at a low price, right? So that's where part of it is. You're buying cheap. You'll hear like Benjamin Graham's known for saying things like your profitability on your investment is determined when you purchase it. Because you're buying it at a good price, you should be okay. Momentum, which way the stock price is moving. You know, going back to the old sayings, you know, you want to avoid catching a falling knife. Well, if it's cheap and it's still going down versus heading up, that's not where you want to be. Quality, well, in general, when you're investing, you're buying a business, you want a profitable business. So quality meaning profitability. And then size, smaller companies over larger companies. Well, if you're a $1 million company, to get 10% growth, you only need $100,000. If you're a $1 trillion company to get 10% growth, you need a lot more than $100,000. So that to me makes more sense with the direction. And finally, volatility, lower versus higher. I think that to me doesn't necessarily line up as much with the common sense. It does from the degree that if you have a consistent business, you have more predictability on where it's going. So I just want to share all that with the listeners, because I don't want anyone to think, well, Eric's picking these factors that have shown outperformance, but why? I think there's rationale for each of these as to why they've outperformed as well. Now, Adrian, I'll pass it on to you before Eric goes to the next step.
Yeah, those are all great points. And just like the big theme also, Eric is just trying to drive home is how all these companies have just different components. Some of them are in different sectors, different industries. So they're all going to get affected sometimes in different ways. And that's what we all know in the investing world as risk. For example, your analogy, there's this big sumo wrestler. He might be really strong, hard to get around, but he's also not the fastest. So if you're going up against a team that's really fast or a fast environment, you're not going to do well. So the overall environment too is very, very important. We call this the macroeconomic environment. That's extremely important because you could have all these great qualities. You could have found that perfect athlete that is really big, really strong, and really fast. But for example, if they break their leg or something outside of their control really happens, it's going to underperform along with everything else. So understanding and really, like Roshan said, really dig into it and pull back the picture and see what is happening, what the environment is, and what is favorable for these companies and what is unfavorable is really important when it comes to this concept.
Yeah, good stuff. So the reason I was talking about multi-factor and as opposed to individual factors, an assemblage of individual factors, is that by having looking for elements to add to the portfolio that manifest multiple factors, or in a favorable way at least, is that it can serve as protection in some ways against the excesses of other factors. So let me give an example of that. When you put together, for example, momentum, and I guess maybe I should say one more thing about momentum. I had said that 3, 6, 12-month trailing momentum was predictive of forward, probabilistically associated with better than expected or better than average forward returns. That only lasts for maybe another 6 to 9 months. Don't think of that as lasting years and years and years. So it's a thing you probably need to do for check in on the momentum attributes of the things that you include in your portfolio. But here's why. So let's say that you do have a really high momentum stock, and yet it is super, super expensive. That versus its low-priced counterpart, probably you'd want to have, the risk there is that it could revert to the mean or regression to the mean, move back into a place where it's that potent momentum that it has been manifesting is now coming back to normal. How much it comes back to normal may be associated with how overpriced it is to begin with. So it can protect you if you're loving the momentum element in your portfolio, to then have an appealing valuation on what it is that you're owning, even while it has strong momentum. Let me use another example. Let's say you love the value strategy and you love to find things that are on sale. Well, sometimes things are on sale for a reason. They're just not that great. So if you then have an overlay of quality that at least, if not focusing on ultra high quality, at least it's weeding out bad quality, you can protect yourself from something known as a value trap. And so these things can work together in very positive ways. So I have talked about the application of these in previous episodes of our show, and I just thought, let's just go a little deeper and let me talk about, draw the curtain back here a little bit and talk about the way in which I think about constructing some of these portfolios. And to do that, I also just need to give credit where credit is due. So I have been influenced in my thinking about factor-based investing by a number of people that I have just extremely high regard for. And these include, but are not limited to, the folks at AQR, Applied Quantitative Research. Cliff Asness there is one of the just most outstanding writers that you'll ever encounter. In fact, I'm going to, in the show notes, provide a link to a paper that they have just published in the Journal of Portfolio Management, which is talking about factor investing. It's about 40 pages, but it's a phenomenal read, and I think you'll find it extremely edifying in terms of your own thinking. But beyond being edifying, you'll also find it's extremely entertaining because Cliff is an amazing writer. Another group is the folks at O'Shaughnessy Asset Management. And first was James O'Shaughnessy, the father, and now Patrick. They've done some really fantastic research there, and they're very generous in publishing the fruits of that research. Still another would be the folks at Alpha Architect. And so you've got a number of researchers there, and they're also very generous with their research. So you can go to alphaarchitect.com. And look over the blog posts there. Meben Faber is another one that I would point to, and many others. But just so you know, still another place is just all the folks that so generously post their pre-publication academic papers at the Social Science Research Network, or SSRN. If you have an interest, you can go there as well and find these sorts of things. So my bottom line is there's a lot of what I'm doing is really not because I'm some sort of genius. I'm just a reader, and I know how to put, I found a way to implement these ideas. So let me talk about I'm going to talk about three strategies. There's actually five or six strategies that I run that are in one fashion or another factor-based. And or that are algorithmic in some way, but I'm going to talk about two in particular today, and just mention a third. So I'll just mention the first of these that I'm not going to go deep on, so I can just dispense with it and then move on to the other two. This one is mostly a momentum strategy. It's not focused on value. It's not focused on quality. It's just looking at multiple instances of momentum with a volatility control. Because I have experience with highly volatile stocks that have good momentum, sometimes will just collapse on you. And since I also apply a timing overlay, that doesn't work so well. But I express this through exchange-traded funds. And so I have 100 different asset classes that are covered, different styles, different sizes, different sectors, domestic, international, currencies, countries, commodities, you name it. It's just giving the math a chance to look at a gazillion things. That's not a technical term. A gazillion things to see at any given moment which of those are showing the most appealing momentum properties. And in this case, what I do is use a variously weighted approach to the two standard approaches to momentum measurement. I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel. They are take the last 12 months of price movement or total return movement. I'd say total return movement. Drop, though, the most recent month. Because the randomness of the most recent month, you don't want to let that influence you. And then stack up all of the different candidates for potential incorporation into your portfolio and go with the ones that are showing the best momentum. The other thing, though, I do is I weight that with not just the 12-month minus one, but the 6-month minus one, the 3-month minus one. And then all of those, I'm looking, of course, at positive momentum as the contribution. I do one last piece, which is the most recent month's momentum. I actually reward if it's down, because I figure I want to catch something in a little bit of a pullback rather than a something that's just blown higher in the last month. I don't want to be caught in the move back down on something that's been blown higher. I'd rather be part of the recovery of something that was actually harmed in the last month. And doing that, what it works out to be is at times it'll just all be in cash because I have a timing filter that looks at where things are. And if everything's just breaking down, then I say, you know what, it's below such and such a moving average. There's no need to get be impatient about this. We can just keep some of this money in cash and wait until some other ideas surface. As it stands right now, that model, which I traded yesterday, And I trade twice a month. So half the portfolio goes on a month-long ride from the last day of the month. The other half of the portfolio goes on a month-long ride from the middle day of the month. And that way, it's taking 24 snapshots of all these different asset classes each year and just rotating itself into position. And what's been its favorites lately has been things like master limited partnerships. Those are the pipelines that carry natural gas and crude oil and refined oil products around the country. It's liked high dividend yield stocks. It has liked more recently Mexico and some other energy plays and so forth. So it is, and it's liked about 40% of the money in cash. So on that basis, I imagine it'll start to pick up. But you can see from that, at least, it doesn't have 100% conviction that everything's back to normal and it should be all in. But it certainly does have a presence, and it's been working reasonably well. I did compile some numbers, so that I'll just consult this in just a second. I'll show this table a little bit later. But on a trailing 12-month basis, as of the close of business yesterday, that was up 1.96. Compare that to the S&P 500 that was down 9.54 on a trailing 12-month basis. The international markets down, as expressed in the all-country world index, down 5.72, and aggregate bonds down 5.13. So, in that sense, at least on a trailing 12-month basis, the momentum was protective in that area, sometimes by staying in cash, sometimes just by getting on the things that were working.
Eric, I think this is a disclosure time with those yes. numbers. So I assume those aren't audited numbers. Those are numbers you're tracking. Please, these is for informational purposes only. Don't make any investment decisions based on this, et cetera. All right, now.
And I'll just say where I got those numbers, it's from, we use a performance reporting tool called InvestNet. And so it's, those aren't performance numbers that I personally compiled. Those are taken directly off of InvestNet's own calculations of those performances. So any questions about that momentum and volatility oriented strategy or sort of comments about it?
Well, so let me ask, and you may be repeating yourself, but that strategy is only looking at momentum and volatility. It's not looking at value, quality, and
correct.
Size.
That one is not.
And how does the you had mentioned 40% in cash? Mm-hmm. Is that the most that's been in cash over the last year, or
no.
is it lower than where it
so
was?
So that strategy can be either all in, or sometimes I've seen it be actually. Levered a little bit. So it'll sometimes I give it one opportunity to have a 2x on the S&P 500, and I give it one opportunity to have an inverse on the S&P 500. So in some instances, it has been as much as 120% invested.
And when you say one instance, for twice the S&P, mm-hmm. how many different slices of the pie are there in this strategy?
It ranges. Sometimes I've seen as few as 4, 5, 6, and other times as many as 10 or 11. It depends, because I have four different voting systems that are all expressing their opinion, and then we just take the blended reports of those four different voting systems.
All right. Excellent. Adrian, any questions on this? This was the one you were going to go over quickly,
yes.
right? To go deeper into the others.
Maybe stuff. I'll pick up the pace on the others.
It seems like there are just, and just correct me if I'm wrong, I'm just trying to help our listeners and viewers just follow along with this. It seems like there's multiple filters in a way. I heard you use that word where you have a filter for momentum, and I'm assuming you have like a filter for value where you have all these different investments go through these filters, and this filter kind of takes out different characteristics saying, all right now we don't want that in this type of market, we'll take that out. You end with this stocks. So am I kind of following along with how that really works?
Yeah. Let me just be clearer about that. So there are many ways of using a filter or some sort of limiting principle that says, hey, although this may be among the strongest momentum plays right now, everything is getting bashed. And probabilistically, when things are have triggered this particular filter, even if they are the strongest of the momentum set, it's probably still not a particularly wonderful time to be invested in them. So I am just gonna, if this filter is triggered, then I'm just gonna move this over to the sideline. What's an example of a trigger? So one thing might be that if you saw a different asset, let's say a broad market index like the S&P 500, doing something that is likely to carry with it all of its friends and relatives, either up or down, then you'd probably say, all right, maybe that's not the best time if that one is suffering. Or in my case, what I do is instead use a moving average. And so there's various moving averages that people will use. A very popular one is, and every one of these, by the way, is arbitrary, but a very popular one is the 200-day moving average. So if something is below its 200-day, forget about it. If it's above it, okay, it's eligible. And there are many other moving average choices that people will use, simple moving averages, exponential moving averages, and more. They'll use moving average crossovers and many other sorts of approaches. But in my case, I use a single moving average that, based on my research, it seems to indicate that above that moving average, your probabilities are better, and below that moving average, your probabilities are worse. I figure I can wait some things out in cash. This is partly to protect capital. Yeah. All right. So the next strategy I'll talk about is one which is, since we're talking again about value, quality, momentum, size, and volatility as among these, this next strategy is size agnostic. So it doesn't really ever measure how big a company you are, and therefore it has a very expansive universe of things to consider. And that.
So Eric, just one question on this. Will you go to Nano, which is 5 million, as small as a $5 million market cap?
No, good question. I find that the behavior of the Nano and the micro stocks is sometimes a little misleading. And when you're trying to compare them with other larger companies, it's a little misleading. So what I do is I go down to the lowest edge of small, just before micro. It also means
so that's about 200 million.
About 200 million. And so anything that's 200 million or larger is initially eligible for consideration. And so that usually means on any given month, it might be 4,500 different stocks. I won't accept things that are over-the-counter stocks, so it has to be on an exchange. And there's a few other screens that I use. But anyway, somewhere in that neighborhood. So size agnostic. But it's looking for those things that on a blended basis are in the lowest quintile. So quintile, again, listeners, is the fifth. It's in the cheapest fifth of all the stocks that have been actively trading on the markets for the last year or more. I'm not looking for things that have just surfaced in the last year. Next, they also have to have the strongest momentum in the top quintile of momentum in the last 6 months. But I'm also looking at momentum on the 12-month and on the 3-month. And I, again, apply that same timing filter that I was talking about before. If they're below this moving average, which suggests odds are poorer, why incorporate them into the portfolio? So this particular strategy, which I call, because I'm not a very great marketer, I just call things with as reminders to me what they stand for, is value, quality, momentum, and timing. So the T in the timing or trend is that last filter, the value I've already discussed. The value, by the way, is not just one. You'll find some people have a love affair with one or another measure of value. For example, book value. What does it cost per dollar of book value? Or what does it cost per dollar of earnings? Or what does it cost per dollar of fill in the blank? And I found that different industries will sometimes not need a lot of book value to be highly profitable. And so I don't want to get dragged down by, or in other cases, they may have, tons and tons of sales, but not necessarily very high margins. And so what I use is a multiple measures of value. The typical ones that you hear about, price to earnings, let me just give you an insight into this. I reverse those. So it's earnings to price, sales to price, yield to price, dividends, share buybacks, et cetera, to price, but also not just price. because price masks, price alone at least, as the denominator in that relationship, masks a potential hazard. And that is a company that's just going bananas on loading up with debt. It may be that, yes, on their, compared to their market capitalization, they have these really high numbers. But when you look at their total body of working capital, both their equity and their debt, then you start to say, that doesn't look so good anymore. So another way of substituting something in for that price factor or market capitalization in the denominator is to use the combination of market cap and debt, long-term debt, and that is known as enterprise value. So we look at EBITDA to enterprise value, EBIT to enterprise value, and so forth. Anyway, when all of those things are put together, so we're looking for the cheapest quintile of stocks on these blended basis, the fastest momentum, and then we apply a bad quality screen. Here, we're not insisting on necessarily top quality. We just don't want to have bad quality because we don't want to have value traps. And so that usually means that we eliminate around 20% of all the candidates just because of bad quality. So now we're dealing with the 80% top on quality, the 20% cheapest by multiple measures of value, the 20% fastest marching forward, and then apply our trend filter. That strategy, value, quality, momentum, and timing over the last year, that is to say, ending at the close of business yesterday, so on a trailing 12-month basis, was up 1.58. I previously already cited where the S&P 500 and all those other things were. And that's in part a function of it didn't get beaten up too terribly bad last year. That strategy is I rotate every month. So today is a new implementation day. Last night I was up finding the ones that have been disqualified because they breached the filter, the timing filter, and now we'll replace them with three new candidates. So anyway, that's VQMT.
So Eric, how many stocks are in there? You said you're replacing three. How many are you starting with?
I always attempt to have 50. I think 50 gives me enough diversification, but it also it puts us in a position where we're not so diversified that we're diluting those factors. So I'm looking for the top 50, and which ultimately means, though the starting point or the initial attribute is they have to be in the top quintile, in many cases they're in the top decile of momentum and value.
So, and if you're replacing three this month, is that a common month? Do you typically have, you know, almost 100% turnover? That'd be 36 out of 50, or what's typical?
You know what? It varies a lot. I would say it is a fairly high turnover thing because of the timing element to it that I described. So in that case, I would say it can be anywhere from I've had as few as one or two to as many as 20 or 30, especially when the markets have plunged and the timing has triggered a lot of them. It might be that 30 leave and they are just replaced with their proceeds are just held in cash. But that model, which is constructed on the composition of this most recent to today, so I can't tell you the attributes of today's precisely, but since there are only three of the 50 that will change, let me just talk about some of the attributes. And in fact, I'll just share my screen on this one so that you can see this report right along with me. So what we're looking at, this is a Morningstar portfolio snapshot that takes the positions and their relative weights and says, okay, doing an x-ray on what's inside them, what is the nature of this portfolio right now? So you can see on the U.S. stock side that currently this is about three quarters is in U.S. stocks and about a fifth to a quarter is in international stocks, so all stocks. You see also that in terms of where it's weighted, it's weighted a lot in cyclical and hard assets, more than aggressive growth or classic growth, or let alone speculative growth, which stands to reason by virtue of what we're looking for. In this middle column, you're looking at some valuation multiples. And so here, price to earnings for this portfolio as of January 31st was 6.98, or call it 7, a price to earnings ratio of 7, which most people would say that's, you know, if you can find a blended PE of 7, you probably have tapped, you know, something useful in this way. That would be compared to the benchmark. What's the benchmark? Well, this is a synthetic benchmark that Morningstar composes when they see essentially 78% of it in U.S. stock. They assume S&P 500, 22% of it in international stock. They assume the international equivalent, I'll call it, of the S&P 500. That has a PE of 17. So this is not, it's about 40%, let's call it that. The PE of this is only 40% as great as the benchmark. So that's appealing.
Well, and Eric, while you're comparing benchmark, I think it's worth noting the S&P is over 20, right? And I know this is different because it's not all large cap like the S&P is, but just the fact that most people know that index, I think that's a good good point of comparison.
Okay, yeah, good point. So this is also on a price to book basis, not quite, a little bit more than half of the benchmark on price to book. Price to sales, this is you only have to pay 50 cents for every dollar of sales. That's pretty sweet, because in the benchmark, you'd have to pay $1.91 for each dollar of sales. And how much does a dollar of cash flow cost? A dollar of cash flow costs $5.10 in this group of stocks, whereas in the benchmark, it costs $12.50 for each dollar of cash flow that you would want to buy as an attribute. So here, the cash flow is an attribute, sales is an attribute, earnings is an attribute. So you might think, well, maybe then you're giving up something on the profitability side. A little bit on the net margin, but the return of equity is stronger than the benchmark. The return on assets is also stronger than the benchmark. And the debt, they've got it more under control at 36. The debt to capital ratio is 36% as opposed to the benchmark is 41. So those are some features of these holdings that give you a sense of, okay, what's the basic composition? This gives you some idea of what that basic composition is.
Is there a weighting towards sectors? Is there anything?
Yes. So let me show the sectors here. And now
I know you've got other strategies, so we'll be quick on there. I just want to see what the weighting is and then ask you a follow-up question on there.
Okay. Let me do this and just highlight that don't pay any attention to the trailing returns, because things are brought into this. Pay any attention to trailing returns from this report, which is viewable on the screen right now for those of our YouTube audience. The reason is that, as you know, this picks up new things. It's looking, it's selecting things that have shown very strong momentum. So since it's refreshed every month, the only thing you can glean from this has nothing to do with the performance, but what you can glean from this are things like, what's the current composition? So for example, the current composition here, you see in the blue and the red, we've already talked about that, blue being 78% US and the red being 22% international. If you look at this Morningstar style box, you see, as you would fully expect, it's overwhelmingly in the value column. And as we already said, size agnostic, although in effect, it does tend to focus more on small than large, simply because the universe of small companies is much, much larger than the universe of large companies. And every one of those 50 companies gets 2%, irrespective of its size. But the sectors are shown here. And what you see is it's a little light on cyclicals. It's actually quite light on defensives. It's very, very strong on sensitive, that is to say, sensitive sectors, and extremely heavy right now in energy for reasons that we all can understand. That is that the momentum element of energy has been so strong lately that that has rotated in and been a big part of this mix lately.
So a couple things. Just going back to your performance, you can't look at this past performance because you wouldn't have had these holdings, right? The portfolio changes every month. Next, what you're pointing at with energy is a question I have. Are there any caps or limits to how much is in each sector or industry? Or theoretically, could it all be in one sector or industry?
Theoretically, it all could. And that might be, I've toyed from time to time with having sector caps, but I have felt like since if this were the one and only strategy that I was using in clients' portfolios, then yes, I would impose those. But because this might be, you know, 5 or 10% of a client's portfolio along with a lot of other things, I'm assuming that in the more diversified part of the portfolio, we are getting that broader sector exposure.
That sounds good. And I remember reading, I wish I could have the data points, but if you had, I think it was like 30 stocks, even if you were focused on a sector or industry, you've still got a lot of the diversification of the S&P, not all. I wish I remembered all the details behind it. And you've got 50 in this. So that was just a question I was curious about. Let's, unless you've got anything to add on this one, I'd love to hear about the next one.
Okay. So let me stop sharing again here and just come back and say, when we look at the recent performance of this strategy that we've just reviewed, as well as the recent performance of the strategy that we're about to review, I just want to highlight some things actually that we had talked about in a previous episode. I believe this was about how many years ago was this that we did this? Maybe a little bit more than a year. So we had traced what was taking place with the tremendous outperformance of growth versus value. And so for our listeners, I'm showing a series of charts that we had shown back, I believe it was about July of 2021. If I recall correctly, when we talked on our growth minus value episode, we'll include a link to that episode in the show notes if you want to go back and see that. And probably there again, because we're using a lot of charts, I would encourage you to see, not just listen. Although I understand, you know, you've got other things to do, like snow blowing your driveway. I get it. But the here is a chart of the trailing, or the forward, I mean to say, not the trailing, the forward 12-month performance, relatively speaking, between a pair of exchange-traded funds. In this case, it's the S&P 500 iShares ETFs, IVW and IVE. So these are ways in which you could actually implement these ideas. And IVW is growth, IVE is value. And so what you can see is that in the period, the 12-month period beginning in late 2019 forward for the next year, it was that the growth component was beating the value component by about 30 percentage points per year. That for, if you bought then and held for a year, you were about 30% ahead if you owned IVW and not IVE. But starting roughly a year, maybe 12, 14 months ago, it had flipped. And at that point, if you were instead owning the value side and holding for the subsequent year, you would have found that the value side here would have put you ahead about 25 percentage points against growth. Over, as you can see on the far right side of the screen, this is the period recently where value, for the first time since, let's say, in 20 years, has had this amount of outperformance relative to growth. And growth, for the most part, between purchasing in, let's say, 2006-ish, late 2006-ish, going forward until, I would say, purchasing in early 2022, in that period, it's been almost all growth in large cap. Here is mid-cap. It's the same story. We've seen the biggest mid-cap outperformance going all the way back in this particular pairing of the Russell mid-cap, IWP for growth, IWS for value. We're seeing 20 and 25 and even pushing 30% outperformance on this coming out of COVID. It's cooling off a little bit more recently, but it's still strong. This is putting large and mid-caps together in the Russell 1000. Same basic story, biggest advantage to value since the early 2000s. And then now this is looking at the Russell 2000. This is small caps, IWO for growth, IWN for value. Goodness gracious, this is the most powerful small cap value move that we've seen. And this has been from purchasing in, let's say, March or April of 2020 until now. You have the forward, the 12-month forward returns have been just completely unseen, the advantage to values in over 20 years. So on that basis, and then even in the international sphere, we have a shorter run for these sorts of things, but the iShares ETFs focus on international developed countries, the growth side EFG, the value side EFV. There again, you're seeing this dominance. So that is the backdrop in part to the comment I made earlier. You have to have a certain, you have to have be wired in a certain way for this to actually work, because you have to be willing to endure sustained periods where your purported or expected advantage just isn't sustained, restate that you're suffering through periods of underperformance, and those periods of underperformance can be long ones. Hence, you know, I use that just for value. It's a different story for quality. It's a different story for momentum, but it just illustrates the point that you can go through long periods without seeing the returns.
Eric, on that one, you're flipping from growth to value fully.
Oh, it's just illustrating, even if you held up the two members of each of those pairs that I just showed in your portfolio at any given time, and then just watched what happened in the next 12 months, you would have seen, because each one of those is forward 12-month returns, you would have seen periods where one of them, the growth side, was just trouncing the performance of the value position you had in your portfolio. And now more recently, it's reversed and been a very powerful move in the other direction. But I wouldn't say that that's a tactical strategy that you should swing from one to the next in this example. It's just illustrating how powerful these disparities can be in 12-month performance.
Yeah. And that trend, as you saw with growth, will last for a long time.
Mm-hmm. It certainly did. And much of that coincided with the interest rate environment the Fed induced in the wake of the global financial crisis. Now that they've said we're not going to continue with quantitative easing, the question then becomes, are we now in a period where the stars are aligning to be more rewarding on the value side than on the growth side?
Yeah, and we've discussed this previously. I believe that's the case as well, or not necessarily on the growth versus value, but more the stock picking versus the indexing space, which is why I was so interested in the strategies you have today, shared with us today. Do you have anything to add on the different strategies, how they work, or anything else with that?
Yeah, the last strategy I'll talk about is another strategy where I had, in contrast to the one I talked about just a few minutes ago, where I said I was size agnostic and I was only weeding out bad quality. Mm-hmm. Here, what I'm doing is instead saying, no, I want to focus on giant cash register type companies. Ones that not just in relative terms to their cost, but just in terms of the raw magnitude of their sales and the raw magnitude of their free cash flow, they are the giants out there. Why? Because the thesis here is that in periods when markets are distressed, they will have the capacity that a smaller, less established, more speculative company won't necessarily have to navigate through the uncertainties of that market. So, or that in economic environment. So in this case, it's an emphasis on large, then on instead of being in the cheapest half, the cheapest quintile, they just need to be in the cheapest half. But also instead of being in the from a quality measurement, just weeding out the bad, they have to be really high quality, and then finally they need to pay out a ton of dividends. So this particular strategy, which I'll show you in just a minute, I call, for lack of a better branding term, quality, larger value with income. And this one on a trailing 12-month basis, this is again through the end of January, is up 0.12. Last year, calendar year, it was down 2.89 and so forth. So the this particular strategy also, though, has a you get paid to wait type of element to it, which is that it's paying out dividends. And I had misspoken in a previous episode thinking that it was 9, and I'd revisited a different source for examining some of this. And what I saw was that indeed it is it's a lower payout, more about currently a payout of about 5% on a forward basis using the positions that we currently have in this portfolio. But let me talk about this. I'll share my screen here to illustrate some of the attributes of this particular strategy. So here we had, in the previous instance, we talked about the U.S. stocks being 78% and international being 22%. Here, it's much more focused on international. And part of the reason for that is that on balance, stocks from developed countries outside the U.S., particularly in Europe, pay more generous dividends than is true among large U.S. stocks. So as a result, since this is a dividend hunting strategy in part, this winds up now being over 60% of the portfolio is in international and 40% is in U.S. In addition, whereas in the previous strategy that we discussed, there were 50 stocks, this also has 50 stocks, but that strategy had 2% for each. This overweights the high dividend payers to juice that dividend return. Here are some of the attributes of this. What you're seeing is that the price to earnings ratio here is even a little lower than what we were talking about just a moment ago. You said you might be thinking, well, how can that be? Because you said, Eric, you said that you start by looking in the cheapest half. Yeah, that's true. That's true, but I'm looking in the cheapest half of those that have giant cash flows and giant sales. So that also puts them oftentimes in a more favorable position. And then in addition, I'm looking for ones that are paying out big dividends. So that further tightens up the valuation or the pursuit of value here. So here the PE, instead of at 7, like we were looking at on the previous strategy, is about 6. Versus a benchmark of 14.5. Price to book, a little bit lower. Price to sales, a little lower than the benchmark. Price to sales is actually a little higher than we were seeing on the previous strategy, but still half of that of the benchmark. And then price to cash flow, here you pay $3.67 for every dollar of cash flow. That's a very attractive valuation. And when we look then at the sectors, which was another question that you asked about, again, don't focus on what we're looking at here on the trailing returns, because this gets rebuilt every quarter, it reassessed every quarter. And so, but when you look at the composition of this, what you see is it's not quite as skewed as we were seeing a minute ago in favor of the sensitive stocks, although it is tilted that way, and certainly energy is a big part of the mix. But in this case, cyclical stocks are also a significant part of this portfolio. Defensive stocks, strangely enough, are really not a part of the portfolio. Any questions or thoughts about this? By the way, it says that the portfolio yield here is 8%. 0.24. And my other source says, no, it's probably going to only generate about 5. So we'll see. We'll see. But anyway, it's a high dividend payer compared to what the S&P 500 is paying.
Yeah, S&P is under 2. So even 5 is more than twice that.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at implementing this, you had mentioned on the value, the other strategy that's size agnostic, that's normally like 5% of a portfolio typically. What is this? What do you normally do with this one?
Yeah, this would also typically be, depending on the client, some clients are fine with just holding things, in which case then I don't, even if there is this tracking error problem, tracking error being how much does it depart from the index in terms of its overall movement. But if clients are comfortable with tracking error, and everyone's comfortable with tracking error when the tracking error is to the upside, it's a difficult thing to kind of weather it when it's to the downside. And so those that were in this strategy or any of these strategies actually last year are generally speaking happier having had this as a part of their portfolio than not. But the but here at least the it's every quarter, and there is no timing element to it. So we're not booting things out because they've breached a certain threshold. In fact, if anything, we have a light touch on the momentum side. I don't want to add falling knives into the portfolio, but it is it's really designed to be more, let's curate a portfolio of high dividend paying stocks that are attractively valued. If they suddenly shoot up in value, honestly, then they shoot up in price because they've done really well, great, we've been rewarded. But we don't need to hold them again. We want to go hunting for something else to replace them that will offer us that reversion to the mean and paid while we wait. Any questions about this, or I'll shut off my screen on this one.
No. I find the whole process so interesting, and the holdings. When you look at this, you've gone over the performance numbers over last year. It's held up really well, especially compared to all the index, both of the, or should I say all three of them, correct?
Yeah, certainly on the trailing 12. So this is on a trailing 12-month basis in 2022, where the S&P 500 was down, according again to InvestNet, S&P 500 was down total return. So that means you get to enjoy the dividends. It was down a little bit more than 18, and the All Country World Index was down a little bit, just about 16, and the aggregate bond was down a little bit more than 8, after getting paid. These were down in that first strategy I talked about, that asset allocation, the ETF momentum strategy, that was down 7.65, says InvestNet. The one I just described, the quality larger value with income, was down 2.89, and then VQMT was down 10.7. It's that VQMT strategy is a little bit more volatile. But the prior year, in the calendar year 2021, when the S&P 500 was up 28.71, then the more volatile VQMT was up 36.75. So on that basis, it had it's had about, in each of those 2 years, it had about an 8% edge on the S&P 500. And, so that in although in 2020, it sat on the sidelines for a long time because it wasn't sure about getting back in. So, you're looking at strategies that will behave differently. And if that's okay with you and you like that diversification, with less volatility generally, the factor-based strategies can have a role to play in a portfolio. Again, I'm not recommending these strategies to anyone. I don't get paid differently by my clients if they use these strategies. Actually, I don't charge them for these strategies because we have at our custodians free trades and there's no expense ratio and anything like that. So on that basis, I just want to highlight, this is not a recommendation. It's a discussion of a way of thinking about investing and thinking about ways of implementing these factor strategies in ways that I think you can develop a mix in your portfolio that can serve to create further diversification.
Yeah, and I think this is, as you said, not a recommendation to anyone. It's just a way to think about things. Like, you're going back to your analogy of the sumo wrestler, the bodybuilder, and what was the last one? Was that a sprinter. Track and field, a sprinter, right? It's instead of having all these separate attributes, you're looking for multiple attributes in each position. And that's the way you think about these companies. And you actually are not researching these individual companies or anything like that at all. You're just saying, if you meet these attributes, you're in. And the moment you don't, you're out.
Right.
Exactly. And I think that's what a lot of factor-based investing is. And tell me if you look at this differently. It's you use these factors and then you execute versus diving deep into the quarterly or annual reports.
Yes. Now, I'll mention that there are a couple other screens of some companies that I just find odious to own. And so I won't own them, but I don't want to get too deep down that rabbit hole. This isn't a discussion of the screens there on a values basis that I apply. But nevertheless, thinking about, I've talked about three different approaches. One, taking 24 snapshots of the markets and finding momentum and rotating, always toward good momentum and off of things that are breaking down. Another one that's a monthly approach that is value and quality and momentum. And then one that's just quarterly, by the way, which I implement right after earnings season is mostly concluded, so that all of the information hopefully then can be priced into that stock and I won't get big earnings shocks right away, up or down. Their quarterly, it's more of a patient approach without jettisoning things unless there's a more attractive candidate to replace them.
Yeah. And another thing this shows me with the factors that you've just gone through three strategies and described a fourth is that anyone can utilize these in whatever way they'd like, right? In the sense that's right. That you select the factors that fit what you're looking for and what you believe in, as opposed to adopting any set formula. There's a lot of flexibility mm-hmm. here for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so true.
I thought that was incredibly interesting what we went over today. Eric, do you have anything to add?
I would say if for those of our audience that love to do things themselves, one of the data sources that I would point you to, which is probably the one of the absolute best, but which costs a little bit, is YCharts. So YCharts has a ton of information available to you there. And so that's one source you could consult. Another source, if you're looking for something here, again, it's a subscription. This one's not as expensive, but if you'd like to think about how to implement exchange-traded fund strategies, not so much stock strategies, but exchange-traded fund strategies, and use combinations of momentum and timing, you could go look at etfreplay.com. Not perfect, but at least it has some tools, pardon me, that you would be able to examine. A third source, which is more affordable than YCharts and more will let you do stock research, is gurufocus.com. By the way, none of these ones are we don't. None of them know that we're talking about them. There's no attempt to sell. We have no financial interest in any of these things. I'm just pointing you to some good resources. And then just to learn the concepts and the thinking and the theory, I would point you back to those earlier sources that I talked about before: AQR, Alpha Architect, O'Shaughnessy Asset Management, Meb Faber, and others, and dig in to the concepts that they're reflecting on, and then you'll be able ultimately to reach some convictions about which of these factors you want to try to assemble together, or you may just want to go straight to certain products that various product manufacturers have assembled to try to create multi-factor investment options for people. Just be aware that this is not for the faint of heart, because you do need to be willing to accept tracking error, both to the good and to the bad.
Yeah. And as you said, if you come up with your own factors, we talked about this earlier, but your own factors you're comfortable with, and then you start implementing this, don't be shocked at extended periods of underperformance. So you want to select those factors that you're comfortable with early on, so you've got the conviction to get through to the other side. Excellent, guys. Adrian, anything to add or any questions for Eric?
Yes, I really enjoyed, Eric, you going over all those strategies. It really just highlights some new principles of investing that people might not have heard of or been aware of, just to really dive in deeper and see if it's a good fit for them, if they want to further diversify, smooth out returns, just see if there's anything else that they might be missing in their portfolio or something to help up their game, so to speak. So it was definitely a lot of valuable content there. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Very kind of you. And let's hope our listeners found it valuable as well. I think some of them was saying, I have no interest in managing my own portfolio. I'm out. And that was 2 minutes into this into the conversation. Yeah. But I know we have some listeners that are diehard followers of this kind of thinking and are also very generously listening to our show. So for that subset of our audience, I hope you found this valuable.
Yeah, well, Eric, if I'm allowed to speak for the finance nerds, I really liked it. You know, I'm sure the other finance nerds listening find it very interesting. I think it's valuable to look at all investment strategies and analyze everything that's available. So I definitely appreciate it. Thank you for sharing all the information, all the information on the approach, the methodology, the strategies. We really appreciate it. And for all of our listeners that are here, thank you for staying with us. Please like, subscribe, give us 5 stars, tell your friends and family, and we'll be back next week with another great episode.
Schedule a conversation with Roshan, Adrian, or Eric today at retirementlifestyleshow.com. Roshan and Eric are certified financial planner practitioners. They, along with Adrian, are investment advisor representatives and serve clients across the U.S. with financial planning and investment advice through Arete Wealth. If you found this show helpful, gained knowledge, or enjoyed the time you spent with us, tell your friends and leave us a 5-star review. This will help others discover the show. To access our show notes, to download any of the tools mentioned in today's podcast, to ask us a question, or to schedule a conversation, go to retirementlifestyleshow.com. All opinions expressed by podcast hosts and guests are solely their own. While based on information they believe is reliable, neither Arete Wealth nor its affiliates warrants its completeness or accuracy, nor do their opinions reflect the opinion of Arete Wealth. This podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be regarded as specific advice or recommendations for any individual. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. The show hosts offer investment advice through Arete Wealth Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor, and securities through Arete Wealth Management, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC, and NFA. Finally, our music is The Chance, by Jason Shaw in Audionautix. It's part of the YouTube audio library and it's licensed under a Creative Commons license. I am Ray Voices. Thank you for listening.